I'm going to invite William to come up now and have a go at answering them.
Sounds a bit like the X Factor. I hope you haven't got a red button. Or is that the other one? What's that one? Has Britain Got Talent? Why do you say the Samaritan woman was manipulative? Well, I'm sorry, I may have... I simply said, I wonder. And I don't think she necessarily was. I was just wondering out loud whether she might have been seeking to manipulate Jesus. Does she, in the course of the conversation, appear deliberately to get the wrong end of the stick? I don't know. I was just speculating, and maybe I went too far. So if that's a particular concern of yours... Please don't let the whole evening ride on that. I'm sorry. I was just thinking out loud. If the woman was Samaritan and followed another faith and was married in that faith, would she still be classified as married in the Christian faith? Well, that's a good question, isn't it? And it may well be a personal issue for you. Let me say that marriage is something that God sets up within the whole of his created order. So you go right back as far as Genesis 2, the second chapter of the Bible, and you will find marriage as a foundational principle of the order of this creation. Genesis 2, verse 5, through to Genesis 5, verse 1, are deliberately designed to speak about the building blocks of Genesis 1 as well, but 2 to 5... are deliberately designed to speak to 5:1, are deliberately designed to speak about the building blocks of this created world and why the world as it is as it is in its very structures in the way we see it today. And marriage is dealt with right early on in chapter 2, and it's saying that actually marriage is a what people would call a creation ordinance, something that's there. And therefore, if you get married in the Christian church, if you get married in a sort of secularist registry office sort of occasion, or if you get married as in a different faith, you're married. Yeah, you're married. Chapter 4, verse 21 to 22 suggests that God is looking for certain types of people, such people. I couldn't find it in verse 21 to 22, but I see what you mean. How does this fit with the idea that he calls everybody? I suppose it's the sense that he's speaking to this particular individual and appears to be summoning her particularly. And God seeks such people to worship him. And it's just further on than from verse 21, where he says, "For God is seeking such as these," that is, people who worship him in spirit and in truth. And the idea there is not actually a particularity as to the specific individual when he says God is seeking such as these. What he's looking for is people who will worship him in spirit and in truth. Now, the idea of God is spirit means God's everywhere, and the idea that God is true means there is something that is absolutely true about God, and that he's declared it in and through Jesus. And so when Jesus says God is looking for such as these, those who worship him in spirit and in truth, to worship him, he's saying he's looking for people who come to him, who have God's spirit dwelling within us, and worship him according to the way in which he has declared himself in and through Jesus. See, without revelation from that God, without God declaring himself, you'll never know how to worship him. You'll just be guesswork. Because God, you don't know the first thing about God if God doesn't say anything to you. You've never seen God face to face. You've never been into heaven. And therefore, your very best guess as to what God wants or what God is like is what? A guess. It's speculation. You have no idea without God revealing himself what he actually wants. And so once God has declared himself and shown us what he's like in Jesus, then Jesus says God is looking for people who worship him in spirit. That's everywhere through his Holy Spirit dwelling within us. If we come to Jesus to have our sin cleansed, have God's spirit dwell within us. And in truth, that is to worship him the way he actually wants to be worshipped. So it's to do with revelation and to do with God's spirit dwelling within you. That's what's going on there. Sorry about the slight confusion. I couldn't actually read it and had to have an interpretation from my neighbour. Now, look, here is this is what I really like, the shotgun approach to questions. Three questions, all on one piece of paper. I'm going to try and answer all of them. When are we finishing? 5:02, something like that?
Just before 9.
Just before 9? We've got loads of time. Good. Why should we believe the Gospels? Well, I've just jotted down the first three reasons that came into my head. First, because they're eyewitness material. And because in the first century, eyewitness material was considered to be of paramount importance when you were writing history. We know that because, and if you've got the stomach for it, if you read Richard Baucom's book, Jesus and the Eyewitnesses, he will chart through the non-Christian, secularist historians. And he demonstrates there that in the first century, when somebody was writing history, eyewitness material was the most valued thing you could possibly have. And all the ancient historians demonstrate in their writing that eyewitness is essential. And when you come to the Gospels, you find exactly the same thing. So Luke begins his Gospel by saying, I have gone around and actually got together the testimony of those who saw, those who were there. And when you come to the resurrection of Jesus in Luke 24, you will see evidence, eyewitness evidence, is stressed over and over and over again. And if you read chapter 1 of this Gospel, you will notice John, the Gospel writer, stressing that he saw, that he was there. He was actually an eyewitness. Because in the first century, eyewitness material was absolutely essential. It is written by eyewitnesses. Second, some of you will have come across a guy called C.S. Lewis. C.S. Lewis wrote a fascinating essay called Fern Seeds and Elephants, and he gave it in Oxford. He was a professor of English literature, both in Cambridge and then in Oxford. You might call him a cross-dresser, I suppose, or something like that. Anyway, there you are. He was professor in both places. And in Fern Seeds and Elephants, he says, I have been, rough quote, not exact, I have been reading myth, legend, poetry, and ancient literature all my life. He talks about the Gospels, and he says, this is not any of those things. And then he says, as an English professor, this is either reportage, eyewitness material, or you have to believe that the Gospel writers invented a form of writing that was not then known for the further 1600 years. Because the fictional novel didn't come into existence until, what was it? I don't know the exact date. He doesn't tell us the exact date. But what he's saying is, and then he finishes, in any way an Oxford professor could, he says, anyone who does not recognise this simply has not yet learned to read. He was a lovely Christian man. But it's a good point. When was the fictional novel invented? This carries all the sophistication of emotion, suspense. He's commenting particularly on the phrase, and it was night, which is one of the most suspense-filled moments in the whole of the Gospels, in John's Gospel, at the end of chapter 13. And he says, either you have to accept that this is eyewitness, because there's nothing like it's ever, you don't find it in any other form of writing until, is it 17th, 18th century, I don't know when it is. And so either you have to believe that these guys, all of them, by the way, Matthew, Mark, Luke and John, all invented a form of literature that was not known or seen again for the further 1500, 1600 years. Or you have to believe it's true. So that's a second reason. Third reason, speaking to my lawyer friends, one of whom actually comes to church here, he says when he's dealing with material up in Fleet Street in the courts and stuff, he says when you're looking at witness material, if there's such close collaboration that the story is just absolutely pieced together, so there's precise every detail, you immediately suspect it. And if the eyewitness comes off best, well, in the writing, in the testimony in court, you always suspect it. And when you read these Gospels, you'll find there are faint, slight variations. Not contradictions, but variations that make you say, this isn't a stitch-up. They're just telling from their different angles, just as you get the Daily Mirror and the Sunday Sport, or whatever your particular thing is, you know, to read. I don't actually... Anyway, we won't go into that. But, you know, you get a slightly different angle, don't you? And he's saying... And if it had been a stitch-up, it would all be the same. And if it had been a stitch-up, they would have come out well. But actually, the Gospel writers has come out very badly, because they're not trying to paint themselves in a rosy light. Why else should you believe them? Well, because they're actually true. It's an awful thing to say, but... It makes sense of life, and they ring true when you read them. Why else should you read them, trust them? Because Jesus told us to, and that's the last one. Look, I haven't got time to do your other questions. I'm really sorry. There were three there. There's the first one. I could have given similar answers to the other ones. Sorry, equally long answers. What happens to people who are kind, loving, humble, generally considered good, people who do not know about Jesus or are not Christian? Nicodemus. Get do you download talks here? Get the download from last night. Nicodemus was the chief rabbi of his day. He was the most senior Jewish teacher. He was the best of the best. Not obnoxiously religious, but beautifully, beautifully religious. And Jesus said to Nicodemus, you must be born again. So what Jesus is saying is, it doesn't matter how good we are, you and I can never meet the perfect standards of God. You know that. Let me tell you my point of view. I have fluffed it. You know, I have done things that God hates, that have to be judged. God can't just do the way I've treated other people in my life, as I've just brushed them aside to get what I want. Since I've been a Christian, that renders me unable to be good enough for God. It requires God to give me forgiveness in order for me to get into his kingdom. Last night. Would you please get the download from last night and listen to it? How would you say the joy manifests itself in your life? Well, I'd love a whole week on this, really. Relationship, I think, probably is the primary thing. Relationship with your Creator. I cannot tell you the privilege of being able to speak to God as a father in prayer. To know that he loves me in spite of myself. To be accepted by him. And as I'm going to talk about on Sunday evening, I hope you'll be able to come on Sunday evening, to know that he has my absolute best interest in mind for eternity. It's a huge privilege. I think it's one of the things that makes, if you've got the privilege of coming from a good home, it's one of the things that makes home so wonderful, to be able to be in a place. I still love going home. My parents love me and have always put me and my interests. Even today, I'm 47. They are getting increasingly... old. And even today you go home and they want the best for you. And to know God my Father and to be able to talk to him and to know that I'm going to spend eternity with him and have the privilege of being involved with him in his work, whether in the army as I was or, you know, as a father of children or, you know, with people. It's an immense joy. I think that's the only word for it. And any other Christian, I think, would say the same. So I could have spoken on several things there, but I just took the relationship. How does Jesus expect the woman to respond? What does she need to do? Would you turn... Well, he goes on to talk about, we've spoken about it a little bit, haven't we? Worshipping him in spirit and in truth. So what Jesus is looking for the woman to do, and where is it? It's there. I'm sorry?
Sorry, 24.
Thank you very much. That's extremely helpful. Are you right? 23, 24. God is spirit, and those who worship him must worship in spirit and in truth. In spirit, that is to ask him to come into my life to give me this living water that he's promised. But on its own, that would be like pinning a blancmange to the wall, wouldn't it? I mean, have you ever... Don't try pinning a blancmange to a wall. You can't do it. To worship in spirit, let him come into your life, and it's all sort of airy-fairy. What does that actually mean? And in truth. Jesus has declared the truth. He came down from above, remember. He is over all, remember. And God has entrusted him with all truth. Chapter 3, verse 25. And therefore, to worship him in truth means worshipping him, living for him, surrendering to him as he has declared himself in Jesus. Because he can be known in Jesus Christ. So that's what he's looking for. And the lovely thing about this woman is, just turn over the page, would you? And then I shall climb off this particular perch. And look at verse 39. Many Samaritans from that town believed in him because of what the woman said. He told me all I ever did. So when the Samaritans came to him, they asked him to stay with them, and he stayed there 2 days. And many more believed because of his word. They said to the woman, it's no longer because of what you said that we believe, for we have heard for ourselves, and now we know that he is indeed the Saviour of the world. So they actually came to believe through listening to his word, which makes sense. If he has declared the truth from God, it's listening to his word that enables us to come to believe and to respond rightly. And that's why, you know, we spend our time looking at his word, because it shows us how to respond rightly. Thank you very much, Marcus. I think I'm done. How often do you lay on these suppers? Because I tell you, I want another one. I mean, not immediately now. It's, you know, but when's it happening next? I'll be here, I tell you. Every night.
A year's time. We hope you've enjoyed this evening, and we often find that people who come to this sort of evening say, well, maybe at the moment I'm not convinced, but I at least see that these issues are serious and it's worth looking into a bit more. And you may be thinking, well, how could I actually find out a bit more? There are many different ways you could do that. One, as William has said, is to come back on Sunday night. So Sunday is the third in the trilogy of talks that William is giving from John's Gospel. So Sunday is on How Far Does God's Love Reach? And that's at 6 o'clock back here on the barge. And the meeting will last about an hour and a quarter. And it's not a sit-down dinner, so just so you're not coming expecting that, do eat beforehand or eat afterwards. But we do serve some home bakes at the end, so there are some refreshments. But basically, it's just our standard Sunday service. We sing some songs, some hymns. You don't have to sing them yourself. You can just stand there and listen. We have a reading from the Bible, and then William will give a talk again. And then there's a question and answer session at the end. So you'll get a good idea of what we do on a normal Sunday evening, and you'd be really welcome. So please do come back for that. That's 6 o'clock on a Sunday. Also, if you happen to work in the wharf, every week we have talks here on the barge at lunchtime, on Wednesday and on Thursday. So it happens 3 times a week. And it's just a half-hour meeting. So people come and sit around tables, drink coffee, and listen to a talk from the Bible, such as William has given today. So if you work in the wharf, please do make the most of that. We have some literature on the table over there, which gives you details of the days and the times. What else can you do? We also run a course called Christianity Explored, which I think is the best structured way of exploring the Christian claims. And what you do in this course, which lasts 10 weeks, just 10 sessions, is you watch a video for about 20 minutes, which gives a presentation on an aspect of the Christian faith. You read through one of the gospel accounts during the course, so through Mark's gospel, and you can ask any question you want in the context of a smaller group and discuss things. And I think it's absolutely fantastic as a way of finding out more. We run this course at lunchtime for people who work in the wharf on Mondays, and we run it in the evenings for people who sort of live in the area. Now, the next evening course begins a week today. So Wednesday next week, the next Christianity Explored course begins in the evening. So if that's of interest to you, you just need to fill in, there's a little contact slip, I think it's a yellow slip or something on your table, just to tick if you'd be interested in that course, and we'll send you an email about it. And it's the sort of thing where we say, why not just come along for the first session, And if it's not your cup of tea, fine. You know, we're not going to sort of come round and beat your door down or something. So why not just try it for size? So various ways of finding out more. And the final thing to say is do take away John's Gospel. So it's a gift from us. Take it home. And we would challenge you to read it. So lots of people say, oh yeah, Bible, I've read bits of the Bible. You say, well, when? So, well, yeah, okay, when there's a Sunday school or something. Have you ever read through one of the Gospel accounts as an adult? If not, we dare you to do it. There you go, there's a challenge. It'll probably take you an hour or two to read it all the way through in the sitting. So please do accept the challenge. But we hope we'll see you again on Sunday at 6 o'clock. It just remains for me to say a big thank you to you for coming along. Thank you.